Some official role-playing music to get us started today on the show. Larry Mueller here. And why do we have that? Well, 50 years ago, the role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons was created in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And we'll talk about the legacy of D&D with our guest, Kurt Griesmer. Kurt is manager of K-12 Education Initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He wrote the feature article titled Dungeon Crawling in Lake Geneva, 50 Years of Dungeons and Dragons. That came out in the fall 2024 issue of the Wisconsin Magazine of History. And Kurt has also developed a Dungeons and Dragons module for kids. It's titled Wisconsin Adventures, and we'll talk about that as well as we move along today. Have you played D&D? What questions do you have about the game? Join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Kurt, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Well, 50th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons. Lake Geneva is where the game was born. Tell us about D&D's origins in Lake Geneva.
Yeah, so Gary Gygax lived there with his family and had been a gamer for many years. And in 1967, he had founded a group like-minded folks, International Federation of War Gamers. And by 68, they had enough people together to rent out a hall and bring everyone together to play games, right? Because these are really, you know, they can be very complicated. There's all sorts of great rules for how you can do this, that, or the other thing. But anyway, people really invest in these, right? And they really like to play them. So they rent out the Horticultural Hall. And that's in 1968, which is the year I was born, so I missed it, you know, but near thing. And a few years later, Gary likes this idea of bringing in mythological figures into wargaming. So rather than just the Teutonic Knights charging forward on a battlefield, what if you threw in wizards like Merlin, right? Or what if you went into the Tolkien legends and pulled out, you know, hobbits and elves and such and brought them into wargaming? And he put out a piece called Chainmail, sort of putting those rules together. And back then, right, everything is either word of mouth or by mail, right? Because, of course, there's no internet, right? And you picked up the phone, you called people, and maybe you didn't even get to leave a message yet because the answer machine
was full or something,
right? Was full or didn't, no one had one, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, through the different magazines, the different bulletins that would go out, these newsletters, basically, you know, they put out their rules and say, hey, I'm selling this, you know, what do you have? And people would work on it. And a gentleman named Dave Arneson, a younger guy out of St. Paul, Minnesota, with his own group, right, picked up those chainmail rules and really liked them. And he'd been playing, there's a lot of Daves in this story. So he'd been playing another game with another Dave named, and the name of the game was Brownstein. And in that game, it was a war game where you played somebody with a mission. So rather than just running, you know, a standard scenario, you had a mission to do. So you might be the post office manager, right? And you had to get a letter to somebody else on the other side of the battlefield. Or you might be a general, or you might be a soldier, right? So you had all these roles. And Dave really liked playing that game. So he looked at Chainmail and he said, well, cool. What if we take those ideas and make heroes and monsters, right? So we're going to have heroes fighting these monsters, and then I'm going to put them in a dungeon. So Dave Arneson is credited as being the first dungeon master because he takes these ideas and then he sends his ideas up to Lake Geneva or down, I suppose, south. We always point down. It's not down, but it's across, right? Anyway, so he gets his ideas to Gary. Gary gets very excited and his team in Lake Geneva. And I think it's 1973, so it's a few years. They meet in 69 at this convention called Gen Con, which is pretty important to note that that's what it's called. And a few years later, Dave drives with another friend, Dave McGarry, another Dave, a lot of Daves in this story, who created the board game Dungeon, which was a very set, kind of a tabletop game that you would play. And from all of this, Gary Gygax and his team get really excited about playing. Like, they play Dave's game called Blackmore, and they get super excited about it. And Gary says, send me all your stuff, and together we'll knock out this thing. You know, Gary was a shoe cobbler at the time. I'm not 100% certain if he was still working in the insurance industry. He was he had five children to support, and he needed a hit, right? He needed something to catch. And so Dave sent, I think, 18 boxes of things, lots and lots of material. And Gary starts typing, and he sort of codifies all these ideas that Dave has, all the ideas that he's had, puts it all together. And in 1974, along with other people, right? Mike Carr is influential in this, another game designer from back in the day. And together they put out, in 1974, despite Dave Arneson thinking it wasn't quite ready yet, they put out Dungeons & Dragons. And that's the first set. It's a little box set, wood grain box set. And eventually, fairly quickly, it sells out of its first printing, and they have to keep printing it. And that's when they realize that they've really
got something. Mm-hmm. Did they collaborate well?
I don't know that. I never got a chance to meet either one personally. And so there are historians who spend a lot of time, who have spent years working on that relationship. In the end, they did not. They started working together. And I think there was a great quote that I don't think I used in the article, where Dave Arneson said something like, Gary typed faster than I did. You know, but in the 80s, later in 70, what's great about having history, you can look anything up at any time you want. So feel free to correct me, audience, as I stumble through the times. But Gary starts writing a different set of rules that he's going to call Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And these are some iconic books or hardcover books that come out in the 70s, late 70s. And he's writing these up. And before that, all the copies of Dungeons & Dragons said, you know, Gygax and Arneson, or Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson on them. And when Gary publishes Advances in Dragons, it's Gary Gygax. And he tries to convince people that it's a completely different game than Dungeons & Dragons. Yes. And it goes about that well, and Dave Arneson sues and gets partial credit for the work, but he's out of the company at that point. So he did join TSR at some point in the mid-70s, but I don't know how comfortable their working relationship ever was.
Mm. There's a walking tour of Dungeons & Dragons. It's called The Adventures Map of Lake Geneva.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you see on that tour?
I think that's amazing. So I have not done the tour. I have the map at home. Paul Stormberg created that map. And what I love about Paul's an excellent historian of the game. He's quoted in my article. And I thank all the authors and people who I interviewed and gave me their time to put it together. So that will take you to places where TSR was born, right? So the first location was in the Kay family home. Unfortunately, Kay passed away, and he had invested a lot of money into this little fledgling company, and his widow wanted nothing to do with it and boots Gary and his company out, and it eventually goes in the basement of the Gygax home. So you'll see that where that happens, right? You'll see different locations, and what's great is it's all set up like an old D&D adventure. So it's got the old fonts and sort of the old color schemes from when these are all coming out in the 70s. So it's a great little experience that you can do. You can get the map and you can walk the tour yourself.
You know, back then, how unusual were role-playing games back in the, say, the 70s?
Very, very unusual. So again, just the ideas come out of this. So wargaming has its roots in the Prussian leadership trying to make their generals and commanders better fighters. So Kriegspiel, wargaming, literally, in the 1800s. And adding elements of chance to it, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll roll a die six and see what happens. Eventually, these become games that need referees to be arbiters of the rules, right? Because if you put a set of rules out that are kind of vague, everyone's going to argue for their side, right?
Like, right.
Well, of course that worked for me. And so they need referees to sort of figure out these rules. But there weren't people, right? You weren't taking on a role until these mission-based ideas started coming up. So there's a game that Mike Carr and Gary and Dave all worked on together before D&D called Don't Give Up the Ship. And even though there's not necessarily roles you can play, it's Napoleonic era, so you could be a general that you happen to know. And you could, and people would, you know, become these admirals and these leaders, right? They started feeling that role happen. That's those mission-based games become the birthplace of role-playing games in D&D. So,
wow. So Arbiter of the Rules, is that a part of the Dungeon Master's role? Talk about the Dungeon Master's role.
Sure, absolutely. So so that grows right out of that referee, right?
Yeah.
You're exactly right. So the referee is more or less neutral, right? Looking at both sides and saying, okay, this is how this is going to play out. The DM is not necessarily as neutral. What they're doing is not only do they have an understanding of the rules and help interpret them, they're creating the world, or they're using material that already exists, right?
Yeah.
Because you can buy, of course,
yeah,
anything you want to play the game. But they're the ones who are populating the world with people. There's NPCs, there's monsters, there's weather, there's taverns, there's places to go, there's things to do. And the DM has a grasp on all of that, whether it's a single one-shot adventure, which you're doing in a single night, or a years-long campaign that you're playing with friends in a world that just keeps expanding.
Oh, really interesting to me. We talked to Victor Raymond, a biracial and bisexual Madison man. He has a PhD in sociology, and here's what he had to say about D&D, a game he has played since junior high.
The original games themselves were designed by largely, you know, 20-something, 30-something white male gamers in the 1970s, right? In the 1970s. And yeah, I think one of the things, as we've seen each edition come out, there's been an interest in representation. How are people represented? How can they see themselves in the game? That's always been an open question. Certainly anybody who's LGBTQ, they're gonna have to look pretty hard to see themselves represented in the game. And certainly for people of color, that's been a big issue. I have to tell you, the number of people of color who I know who've opened up D&D books that are, you know, more recent, particularly the fifth edition that's been out since 2014, and said, I see myself here. So being able to see oneself in the art, that's a major step forward for people to say, I can now imagine myself playing a character in this game. I can now imagine this world.
That was Victor Raymond of Madison. And it's been criticized as being a game played mostly by young white males, like the people who first created it. Was that was a fair criticism then, and is it now?
Yeah, I think that was a fair criticism. Although my gaming group in the late 70s, early 80s had two young women in it in high school. So we were we were kind of rarefied air there. But yeah, even the original in the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book, you know, there's charts for all the statistics. One of the things about all your characters, the people you play, they all have strength or intelligence or wisdom. And there's a strength chart that shows that women could not be as strong as men. Right,
like, oh.
That was built in to the game from right away. But like Victor had just said there, with fifth edition, Wizards of the Coast, a company that's been publishing D&D now for decades, made a concerted effort to start moving beyond that and really show what the game is capable of being. Right, you should be able to see yourself in that game. You should be able to play the game that you want to play, which I know is very important to Victor, right? The game that you play should reflect what you want to do. Why would you play a game that isn't fun or doesn't show you something about yourself it's fun to do? So, but yeah, it was a fair criticism, but one of the releases just from a few years back has, as far as I know, my first experience with a non-binary, non-player character. So a they-them non-player character, which was just kind of awesome and eye-opening and really cool to see. So,
Kurt, Griesmer, our guest today, manager of K-12 Education Initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He wrote an article about the history of D&D, and we're talking with him today. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Either a weekday or on Saturday, I would walk down to the hobby shop downtown, and that's where Ernie Gygax would be DMing in the basement, and I would go downstairs and play in campaign. And no, he was very proud of his dad, but he was never like, my dad was co-creator of this. He was equally as enthusiastic as Gary in the storytelling and inviting people to play the game. You know, there for a lot of years, there was a lot of weirdness about what exactly this game was and what exactly was happening. But now there's a big embrace in the community, right? They're like, they're working on a statue that's going to be in the park. That's going to be Gary with his open hand so that you can roll your dice out of his hand and play at the table with Gary. So these initiatives that are happening in town are very exciting. That was exciting. So it's very nice to see everybody embracing it and celebrating it.
That was Lake Geneva native Sonia Ackright. Talking about playing D&D as a young girl with the son of Gary Gygax, the game's creator, of course. Ackright is the incoming director of administration for the Geneva Lake Museum, where there's a permanent Dungeons and Dragons exhibit. So really cool. Just to mention, coming up at noon today, we're going to switch gears entirely and talk about the Brewers season that ended last week with Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, host of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. That's at noon today. Right now, though, we're looking at Dungeons and Dragons, and you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Kurt, nice day. Do you know Sonia?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I met Sonia last year as we were planning the rollout of Wisconsin Adventures Myths and Legends. So
yeah. In the late 70s and 80s, Dungeons and Dragons was condemned by some groups and politicians, if I'm not mistaken. They claimed the game included satanic influences. There were any truth to that claim at all?
No. You know, there's imagery, right? There's demons and devils in the game. They're not the good guys. You know, the heroes are the heroes and the monsters tend to be the monsters. But there's artwork, I'm sure, that they could reference and take a look at. And like anything else that you can misinterpret, if you can misinterpret it and gain some popularity from it, that's probably what was going on. But, you know, a young man... A sad story, but a young man disappears for a while and a private investigator looks into it and pins it on Dungeons and Dragons. This young man played D&D and said, well, obviously he was following in his head a real-life D&D adventure, and that turned out to be completely untrue. He had just gone off the grid, as we'd say today, for a few days, and when he's found... you can't debunk the story, right? The rabbit's out of the hat. A lie travels faster than the truth. And that leads into what's called the Satanic Panic. And, you know, what's the best way to get a teenager to do something?
Yeah, tell them you can't do it.
Yeah. As soon as you say, no, you can't play that game, sales skyrocketed, right? Because suddenly everybody wanted to see what it was about and play the game. I was playing during that time, and my parents... asked if that was the game that was in the news, and I said, yes. And that was sort of the end of it. They were just glad I was reading and kind of staying out of trouble. So there's a lot of reading that goes along with Dungeons & Dragons, a ton of great – in fact, there's a ton of great educational skills, which is why it sort of landed on education to do this out of the Historical Society.
Yeah, and we can talk about that. What have you done as part of that?
Some time back now, everything gets fuzzy. Over a year ago, my supervisor, Abby, came back from a meeting and said, hey, they're talking about the 50th anniversary of D&D. Do you have any ideas? And I said, yes, I do. And I came back the next day with 12 ideas for different adventures based around different ideas in Wisconsin mythology. and quickly realized we could never get all those done in time, and boiled out three of them to create the adventures in Myths and Legends. So we have Night at the Museum, which is an homage to our currently closed museum on the square. And the adventure is actually built on the blueprint of the actual first two floors of the museum, which I will never do again because there's a lot of fake walls in a museum, and you got to draw them all. And then the Hunt for the Hodag, which, of course, based on Hodag mythology coming out of the North Woods. And the last one is The Beast of Bray Road, which is a werewolf myth coming out of the Elkhorn area.
And so kids can play that, and what are they going to learn?
So the very first thing, like I just mentioned, reading is fundamental, right?
Yeah.
It really is to the game. When you open up, in fact, in the 70s, when you would open up that hardcover book, you'd get two solid columns of small text on every page for 150 to 190 pages, interspersed by little bits of black and white art and charts. So you have to know how to read. You have to learn how to read charts. You have to learn how to do basic mathematics, right? You have to be able to multiply, you know, add, subtract, divide, multiply. All of those number skills come into play. And that's just, those are the hard skills, right? Listening to people, learning how to work with people, speaking, public speaking. I get a lot of my public speaking skills from having no fear of talking to my friends about whether we were going to go into the room charging blindly or if we'd sneak in, right? Making plans with other people. A lot of interpersonal skills come into play where if somebody wants to do something else, you have to figure out how you're all going to do the same, you know, how are you going to work together? So there's soft skills that you learn and there's hard skills that you learn, and they all come together in this role-playing game, which is just a ton of fun. And so it gives agency to the learners too. So the DM may come up with this world and this scenario and these storylines, and then you get the players involved and they ruin it because they want to do whatever they want, right? So they might not follow the path that you set up. And as a dungeon master, you're like, and you're rolling the dice and trying to figure out what they're going to do next. But you're co-creating that narrative, right? So you're really working together to create this world, this story together. And at the end of the day, unlike the Brewers, there's no end losing scenario, really, right? Even if your character gets eaten by a dragon, you can sometimes come back to life, or you can roll up a new character and try again, right? There's no win-lose forever in Dungeons & Dragons, so...
How long does a typical game last? How many hours?
That's a good question. I had mentioned earlier, one-shots are usually done in an evening. So there's a lot of board games that take longer than a one evening. So if you ever played Monopoly with a sibling and they're taking money out of the bank while you're trying to play. But, you know, 3 to 4 hours for a one-shot adventure where you're doing sort of a one-mission kind of thing and you have characters that are doing only that mission. Where I know friends who have been playing for 30 years together in a single world campaign that keeps evolving and growing. So it really depends. But 4 to 6 hours per session is not unusual.
And I'm wondering how many people, I mean, could one person play it by themselves? What's a sort of a good number of people that it would take?
Yeah, my favorite is five. So anything between 4 to 6 players and then me running a game, that works out really well for me. People have different levels of being able to handle different groups and how they split off. I remember that I think the first rules, because it comes out of, remember, D&D comes out of wargaming. It's not role-playing, so it's the first real role-playing game. And they have a rule, they have something that says, like, for your first game, limit your table to about 20 players. 12 to 20. I'm like, I don't know how you could do that now, right? The game is very different now. 4 to 6 people who want to play, it seems like that's my particular number, but it's going to be different for every group and every game master, every dungeon master out there. Mm-hmm.
And is it ever played, I would assume it is, via Zoom or Google Meet or something like that?
Yeah, I got a great quote from someone at Roll20, which is one of the online places you can play these. So there's Roll20, there's D&D Beyond, which is the official Wizards of the Coast site. There's all sorts of places that are online tabletop role-playing venues, basically. And during the pandemic, they saw this explosion in growth of online play because it wasn't really safe to get together in person and play the game. And people still wanted to have these social experiences because that's what D&D is. It's a social experience where, you're creating these stories together that you're going to remember forever. Well, mm-hmm. Not forever, for a long time. So online became a way of seeing everybody and playing. And so you'll see a map on your screen. There'll still be a dungeon master, you know, running the game. And all of you will be in your little, you'll have your little icons and digital miniatures are going to be up there. So yeah, online gaming really came into its own during the pandemic. And I think the quote is something like they could see actually the spread of the pandemic by the growth in the numbers of people using their online platform.
Interesting. I want to go back to ownership for a minute and just sort of review some of the things you said. TSR is the company Gary Gygax formed to publish D&D books, the modules, other materials. And, of course, the popularity has steadily grown. But the company, you mentioned the company went bankrupt.
Yeah, they functionally went bankrupt in the 90s. And well before that, Gary Gygax had lost control of the company. So Dave Arneson, of course, had basically been shown the door before that. So the founders were all out of the company by the time it went bankrupt in the late 90s, and Wizards of the Coast bought them. They reinvested in the game at that point. They looked and said, okay, well, let's bring this back to what it was. And they spend a lot of time and effort and energy on Dungeons & Dragons, making it what it is. There's different editions. So the first edition, those first hardcover books, we're up to edition 5.5 now. Wizards put out a third edition for sure, and then fourth edition, third, 3.5, fourth, and fifth. But the popularity of the game really took off with fifth edition. And I couldn't tell you the exact reasoning behind why that is, but part of it is the game is easier to play. So fifth mm-hmm. edition, my daughter wanted to learn how to play, and we all dug out our first edition books rather than buy anything new. We were like, okay, my friends and I, we dug out our first edition books and we tried to teach her how to play that. Really complicated stuff. There's things like Thaco and negative mm-hmm. armor classes and all sorts of things. We're like, wow, how did we learn this when we were kids? But fifth edition, when it came out, I bought the starter set. I read through the starter set. I came back to my group and said, we're going to change. Everyone should spend $30 on a player's handbook, and we're going to move over, because the game was made easier to play. It was just as exciting. They made it different, but not significantly, not a game you didn't recognize. When you looked at fifth edition, you recognized the roots of the game from where it came from. And yet, for my daughter, instead of that learning curve that went sharply up, it was a mellower learning curve that we could all take part in together.
How much money has that company made on?
Millions and millions, right? The interesting about D&D is you can buy one, two, or three books and never buy another thing. So you can create your own adventures. You can create your own worlds. All you need are the basic rules to play. There's the SRD, which, as I said before, it's either system reference document or system resource document. That's available for free online that's compatible with 5th edition. So there's a very... There, you can invest as much or as little as you want. But what really happens is they create modules, so adventures that people can play, right? People will buy those. They'll create character sheets that people can, you know, use. Now you can just download character sheets. They create these online environments like D&D Beyond, where you can pay for a subscription service to play online and have all your books online and all the rules built into systems that help you go. So there's all these mechanisms and avenues for being able to make money off the game. But again, it's something that you don't have to invest in any more than you want to.
Conventions. You did mention conventions. I think in 1967, you mentioned that Gary Gygax started this Lake Geneva gaming convention. I think they referred to it as Gen Con.
Yep. So Gen Con, actually, I think it might be 68, the first Gen Con. The group he forms is 67, the Federation of Wargamers.
Okay.
But I don't think they called that Gen Con 1. Again, if you're out there and you know the answer, I'm happy to listen because, but yeah, Gen Con still goes to this day. It went from it got too big to be in Lake Geneva anymore, moved around. I think Platteville had one. To different universities. It ends up in Mecca Arena in Milwaukee for some time, and then gets even it's huge. And when Wizards of the Coast buys it, they decided to move Gen Con to Indianapolis, where it's still run every year today.
And how many? I mean, there's 50, 60,000.
Easily, yeah. Tens of thousands of gamers descend to play the games, and volunteers make the world go round. I'll be running games at the one coming up here, Gamehole Con in Madison. I'll be running games based on the work that I've done for the society. But, you know, that's all time that that the DMs just go and say, I'm going to run this game. And you've got volunteer organizers saying, great, we're going to put together the players with the gamers. And it all comes together. And I couldn't tell you how it all works, but it just does. It's great.
And it wasn't it, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, there weren't those conventions or many of them before the first one that Gary threw.
Yeah, I don't know the history of gaming conventions across the United States, but I can tell you that in Wisconsin alone, there are now dozens of conventions of all stripes. So you, fandom, which is sort of the general catch-all for everybody who's into these things, is multifaceted, and you can find a convention based on anime series. You can find conventions based on comic books. You can find conventions based on games, which we're talking about today. So there's just dozens just in our state alone in different different parts of the state in different sizes, right? But all across the country, all over the world, there's gaming conventions and science fiction conventions and Star Trek conventions and all. It's a lot. It's a lot.
And Gary's the Gary Con is still going in Lake Geneva.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So is there something that sets that apart from other gaming conventions?
One is the legacy of Gary Con and Gary Con Zero. When Gary passed away, I think it's in 2008, his friends gathered together, as he would have, I'm sure, wanted them to play games. And they call that Gary Con Zero now. And they decided, we're just going to do this and make it a thing. And so from that time to today, and I don't know what number they're on. Sorry, I don't have that memorized. But today they've steadily grown. And the 50th anniversary, of course, was huge for them, too. And looking forward to next Gary Con. Just spoke with Josh the other day, and he's excited. I mean, it's a very exciting time to be part of this Dungeons & Dragons experience.
Yeah. You know, we talked to Royce Thigpen, the IT and website director for Gamehole.com. It's a mid-sized fantasy gaming convention taking place in Madison next week. And this is what he had to say.
90% of gaming conventions don't exist if Dungeons & Dragons was never created, right? So our early shows were very much, we're going to be running a D&D con, but we're not going to be exclusively D&D. We're going to have other stuff in, because most people who play Dungeons and Dragons also play other things. They play board games, they play other role-playing games. So we will be pushing around 7,000 people on site this year.
Amazing. Royce Thigpen talking about the 12th annual Gamehole.com, which is October 17th through the 20th at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison. And again, started by a group of D&D players.
Yeah.
D&D for kids. Let's go back to that historical society, Wisconsin Historical Society game that you developed for kids. You mentioned that one of them is set. Talk about the different settings that people might be involved in.
Sure. It was a lot of fun to work on. The first thing you need is a small village to get started in, right? And I needed a reason for Wisconsin to exist. It's a fantasy game, but why is Wisconsin in this fantasy world? So I looked at some stories of how to get there and settled on the wreck of the Christmas Tree Ship, which is one of the most famous shipwrecks in Wisconsin, which I've heard Tamara Thompson talk about on this show.
Yes.
And so for more information on that, I highly recommend our maritime archaeology team. But I took and did a fantasy spin on that, cracking some sort of magical barrier, and suddenly Wisconsin's now part of this Dungeons & Dragons-esque world. And the place I settled on was our own historic site, Wade mm-hmm. House. So the village of Wade comes out of Wade House, because up at Wade House, they've got a blacksmith shop, they have a sawmill, They've got a tavern. You know, it's a very neat little environment to get your party started up. And so the heroes come to Wade. For whatever reasons, the heroes show up in these places, and then they sort of find out the rumors, what's happening. They get recruited right away because there's missing villagers. The villagers have disappeared in the swamp, and in the swamp, there's an ancient place of learning called a museum, and they need to, and there's a missing knight, which is why it's called Knight at the Museum, who also went to try to find the villagers, and that knight never returned, and so she's missing, and the players then have to go find out what happened to everybody, and they have adventures as they get through, and all of it's historically inspired. So to get to the museum through the swamp, they have to travel down an old plank road, right? And because that was a thing, and because plank roads were often private, I have an old rotted toll booth gate at the front that players can investigate and find old coins that say something in we trust on them, you know, like, so, but that's all sort of all these little pieces of history that get that are baked into what I know about Wisconsin, and what I was able to research was so much fun to put into this. So, again, it's a little homage to our own museum that is currently closed as we build a new Wisconsin History Center, which will be open in a couple of years. And we're really looking forward to that because it's going to be fantastic. But a lot of love for that old building that we all kind of hung together with duct tape and baling wire, sometimes literally. And so kids, when they play, again, it's not hitting them over the head with the hammer of education, right? We're not testing them on whether they remember anything from the module. But when they rescue the knight, the knight's name happens to be Bell the Crazed. And Bell the Crazed comes from the fact that the word follies translates from the French as the crazies. And Bell La Follette is a historic figure in Wisconsin. So Bell the Crazed is a knight doing the best she can to be good and, you know, take out the bad guys, and the players have to rescue the knight. You know,
It sounds fascinating. Kurt Griesmer, our guest today, manager of K-12 education initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. It's great to have him with us. He's written about the history of Dungeons and Dragons. It's great to have him with us. I hope you'll join in. Questions or comments, maybe have you ever played? I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Being in a D&D environment and playing the game with friends, it is improvisational theater of the mind. You know, you are playing together to create this shared story, and you get to have a funny voice, and you get to invent dialogue for a character that was, you know, a paragraph thumbnail sketch in a book. And sometimes those can be powerful and profound and meaningful as well as fun and fun.
That was Ben Klepczyk, Director of Integrated Marketing and Communications for the University of Wisconsin Memorial Union and a Dungeons and Dragons player. He started in middle school and now, I guess, quit for a while and now again restarted as an adult. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on the show we'll talk with a registered nurse about misinformation and misconceptions around surrounding clinical trials, and then we'll learn about lung and pancreas transplants. That's tomorrow on the show. Right now, we're talking Dungeons and Dragons with our guest, Kurt Griesmer, manager of K-12 education initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Give a call if questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You have the mythical Hodag involved in one of the creations that you developed.
Yeah, the second adventure. So D&D is based on your character getting better at what they do. Right. And that's part of the emotional investment in the game. As your character gets better at what they do, you get more powers, more skills, more spells. It just becomes a more complex and rewarding experience. So after you finish Night at the Museum, you level up to level 2. Woo! And you go at level 2 on this Hunt for the Hodag mission. And the Hodag most likely comes from oral traditions of indigenous people telling their stories to the lumberjacks and loggers up north. And one of those loggers, Eugene Shepherd, heard that and thought, cool. How can I make some money off of this? And he and his buddy Luke Kearney, they create a large, you know, probably papier-mâché wires hodag. And they invent a mythology around it, like it drinks only the blood of white bulldogs by the light of the full moon and all this, all these things. And they put it in the dark. They're going to have it at the Oneida County Fair. They're going to charge a nickel or a dime to see the ferocious beast. You know, they get photo shoots taken of it, like with this hodag with its foot resting on a child in the woods like this. And they're all surrounding it with their rifles. And you know, they have a lot of fun with this, hodag idea of this hoax, and eventually they're kind of caught out. I want to say that someone, some scientists from New York were really excited about this new creature they had found, and they're like, oh no, wait. So, but they had a lot of fun with the idea. It wasn't his only, thing that he did, but it was one of the, coolest things. And so in Hunt for the Hodag, players are told about this. You know, something's killing the livestock, and they have to go figure out what it is. And they go track down this field, and they find this weird burn spot that smells kind of like, you know, cooking oil. And so there's elements of a hoax, but it could be a real dragon. It could be anything. And they go and fight some bandits. I've got my friend's bulldog in there. One of my favorite parts of his bulldog Servo's in there. And Servo's superpower is knocking you down and slobbering all over you. And anyway, the players eventually discover, sorry if you're going to play it, and this is a spoiler, they discover that it's two bandits inside of a costume causing all sorts of trouble. And eventually you confront Eugene Shepherd and try to stop him from his plans of mutton domination. So, and yeah, we had a lot of fun with it. We did a live action version of it here in Madison on Gary Gygax Day. So a celebration of Gary's birthday. And we worked with BID to create a live action version. So all the participating businesses, we had volunteers with dice. And you had to roll the dice and beat a certain number. And if you got higher than the number, you got the real truth. What was really going on? You got a clue. But if you got a low number, you got mythology. So you got a lie. And then they ended at our building where they got to confront. We have our own papier-mâché hodag that our graphic designer once built for us. And we hid it in the auditorium with lights and roaring sound effects and all sorts of things. And then people would come and roll the big foam die and see if they beat the hodag. And we've got great photos, like a little girl who throws a die up in there. She's like, just staring at the die that's flying through the air, and a whole group of people dressed as adventurers all have their hand on the die before they roll it, hoping to beat the hodag. So it's been a lot of fun.
So I'm wondering, could these be played in classrooms?
Yeah, it would be tough to do for a whole classroom, but I have, you know, teachers are some of the most creative and inventive people out there. And one educator came up to me last year and said, you know, I don't have the time to do the whole game in my room, but what we're going to do instead, because I love this idea, we're going to do character development based on Dungeons & Dragons character types. So you can be a heroic fighter. You could be a sneaky rogue. You could be a spellcaster, a sorcerer, a cleric who's a healer. And we're going to develop characters that way. And all the kids are going to create their own narrative of why they're a hero. You know, what was their backstory? You know, why did they decide to become adventurers? And then eventually, anyone who wanted to play, they'd form a D&D club. Because again, D&D is very people intensive to play. One dungeon master can only handle so many people to play. But a D&D club where you have many dungeon masters coming together, if you have a group that wants to do it, and of course, there's ways to modify the game. And again, I leave it to educators who are some of the most phenomenal, creative people with, again, you give them a paper clip and tape and your child knows how to read and write, and, you know, so.
That's an amazing, and you've got a third one, so we've got to go talk about the third version.
Yeah, so the third adventure in there is The Beast of Bray Road, and it's a kind of a classic werewolf story, and what I did was never have the actual Wade House or Wade's Inn in the story. He was always missing. Mm-hmm. And so he's disappeared, and the person running the Wade Tavern comes up and asks you to go find Wade, and it turns out Wade has been cursed with lycanthropy. And it's a whole convoluted storyline that deals with a lot of little Wisconsin pieces. It was a lot of fun to put together. For instance, to cure it, In fact, you don't do any of these things on their own. So one of my coworkers, Michael, I said, Michael, I'm trying to figure out a way to tie together the cure for being a werewolf with Wisconsin history. And he came up with the doctor's name who was the first one to save somebody's life who had full-blown rabies. And that doctor's from Wisconsin. So he...
So we used
that protocol, the name, you know, a version of the name of that protocol, which is escaping me now, even though it's written down and I've seen it hundreds of times over the last year and a half, as part of the cure for the Beast of Bray Road. So there's a lot of ways not to kill things in my module. That was one of the knocks on it from a professional writer. There's a lot of ways not to kill things, but, you know, you want kids to think outside of the box. You want them to think of ways to solve problems. You know, that's the whole goal. So...
Gary Gygax, when did he pass away? It's been...
I think it's 2008. I'd have to look it up to be sure.
You kind of wonder what goes through his mind, because he would have experienced almost from afar. I mean, he started it, or mm-hmm. one of the two people who started it, but he would have experienced its growth.
Yeah, he went through the highs and lows, right, of his own company and watch. He was instrumental in getting the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon made in the 80s. You know, D&D, they were branching out into all these areas, whether they were completely successful or not. There was a vision that this was bigger than just the game, you know, getting incredibly talented authors to write full-blown fantasy novels based on Dungeons and Dragons characters, right, or characters that might be in the worlds. Gary would have, I don't know. Again, I don't know him personally. That and Ernie Gygax is still around to ask. Luke Gygax, who I met at GaryCon last year, incredibly kind with his time. These, you know, they knew Gary, but I can imagine that seeing the way that people still play the game and love it, I think that would have been really gratifying for him.
Yeah,
you know,
I think you hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you kind of hope so. I couldn't believe he got canned from the company. I don't even know how you would get fired from the company that you.
Yeah, just something about shares, you know, different people had so many shares of the company. And eventually enough people who didn't want Gary part of the company owned more shares together than he held individually of that company. So
I guess the story for that is, if you want to keep in the company, you need to keep 51%?
51%, right. But of course, it's difficult because it takes a lot of money to make these things. So you need more investors. You need people to come in and feel ownership of it, right? You can sort of watch the path that everything's following, but history is great that way. You can see what happened, but predicting the future is a lot harder.
Yeah, so. it is indeed. Do you think there's more to come with it? Are there new variations?
Yeah, so Wizards of the Coast, they just put out version 5.5 this year. The new player's handbook is out. We're working on our second module. The title currently is Nightmare Over the Dells, so it's going to be centered around the Baraboo area, and that'll come out next year for... again, like that leveling up concept. So at the end of Wisconsin Adventures, Myths and Legends, you're level 5, and then you're ready for the next set of challenges then in the next iteration of the Wisconsin Historical Society's adventures.
And Patty had emailed wondering about that. Where does she find more information about those? She's got a 6-year-old grandson.
Yeah, so... you can find it online, so wisconsinhistory.org, and then we have our store online, which I believe is shopwisconsinhistory.org, but I'm sure that our team has it, so you can click right on the word shop and get there. And that's where, and we also have an informational website just about Wisconsin Adventures and why we created it and what's all available.
This has been fascinating, Kurt. I want to thank you so much for telling us the history of Dungeons and Dragons. And I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure. I really appreciated it.
Kurt Griesmer, manager of K-12 Education Initiatives at Wisconsin Historical Society. It was great to have him with us. And it was fun to learn, for me to learn about Dungeons and Dragons. I've never played it, but it was fun to hear about it. And it sounds like there's some excitement to come for our youngsters here in the state. Coming up, a look at the Milwaukee Brewers. I'm Larry Mueller.